Good morning and assalamu alaikum. Welcome to Family Life. Your hosts, Salima Muhammad and Dr. Nadia Muhammad. Dr. Muhammad will join us in the next few weeks. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent, Laurent Speaks. In the name of Allah, the most gracious and most merciful, I greet the listening audience and the peace of assalamu alaikum. Happy New Year to all. As we begin a new year, we begin our series. And today we are honored with the guest from Washington, D.C., Imam Lyndon Amin Bilal. Brother Imam Lyndon Amin Bilal is a U.S. Air Force veteran who served in the military from 1980 to 1993. Originally born and raised in Gary, Indiana, currently residing in Washington, D.C. since 1988. He served as a special assistant to Imam Khalid M. Sharif, resident Imam and president at Masjid Muhammad, the nation's mosque, Washington, D.C. Presently, he is the national commander of the Muslim American Veterans Association, also known as MAVA, which began in 1997 as post number one in Washington, D.C., and now has several posts around the country. Brother Yan is a founding member of the Muslim Military Members, MMM, organization, which facilitated getting the first Muslim chaplains officially sworn into the U.S. military in 1993. For the past 4 years, he has been responsible for writing a very popular weekly article in the Muslim Journal newspaper called MAVA Speaks. In 1992, he hosted a historic luncheon in honor of Imam Wazim Muhammad at the Pentagon, a day before Imam Muhammad became the first Muslim to open the Senate in prayer. Additionally, the great boxing legend Muhammad Ali, also in 1992, he performed the Hajj, the fifth pillar of Islam, as a part of the first delegation of the U.S. military members hosted by Saudi Arabia government as a show of appreciation for America's role in Operation Desert Storm and Desert Shield. Professionally, he worked as a computer network engineer and has a BS degree in computer network engineering and AA in electronic systems technology and several sought-after technological certifications. Brother Imam, welcome to our show.
Assalamu alaikum, rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for inviting me, Sister Salima. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on your program and to be able to share, hopefully, some inspirational and aspirational messages in this new year of 2021. And I'm just grateful and thankful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for keeping us, me here, to be here on this special occasion.
Yes, sir. I would like to start many years ago, and I thought it was so poignant. And as we begin the new year, you gave a Jumu'ah khutbah and it was entitled Peace Until Dawn, Kabir versus Karma. And he made a comment with regard to the dawn of Friendship Prayer. And he said the world man created challenges our resolve. So as we start off at the dawn of the new year, can you elaborate on this and then associate it with current day challenges? If you would, please.
Okay, I will do my best. First of all, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wahdahu la sharika lah wa ashhadu anna Muhammadan abduhu wa rasuluhu. That is, with Allah's name, the merciful benefactor, the merciful redeemer. All the praise belong to Allah, the garden evolver, cherisher, keeper, and sustainer of all the systems of knowledge. I witness that there is none worthy to be worshipped except Allah. He has no partners, associates, and nothing can be compared to him. And I witness that Muhammad was his messenger and our prophet. So in regards to that particular khutbah, I have to reflect on it because it was done several years ago. But in terms of man's world and God's world, Allah's world, as we know, Allah is the Lord or the owner of all the systems of knowledge. But man, of course, is Allah's creation. And man was not created until he recognized that Allah is the creator. So you can go back to Surah Rahman, Surah 55 of the glorious Quran, where Allah said he created the Quran and then he created man. And so for those who are not familiar with the Quran and with that surah and those ayats, those signs, those verses mean, it's pretty much saying that to be the real man, the human that Allah created, that you have to come in contact with the creation and understand the workings within that creation, that unseen world, that spiritual world. And so what man has done through Allah's creation, he has created his own institutions, his own perimeters, his own laws. But all of those laws must conform to Allah's law, or else they will be oppressive to the human being, or they will be very short-lived, and it will bring among a great destruction and great revolution against it, because the human being was created to serve Allah and Allah alone. And so that's pretty much, I think, what I was trying to say in that khutbah that was delivered at the Ali Khan Community Center, Ali Khan Islamic Community Center in Suitland, Maryland, which is outside of Washington, D.C., about 10 miles outside of Washington, D.C. And before that, I also served for several years, maybe over 10 years, at a place called the New Africa Islamic Community Center here in Washington, D.C. It was on Good Hope Road at Imam Sultan Abdullah's. He had a very popular and successful business. He used to call it DDTP, Designer Discount Trading Post, and later it became Zoe World, where he was the top T-shirt producer in Washington, D.C. And he used to hold Juma upstairs in his first store on Good Hope Road. And I joined them, and, you know, I did a lot of cut bars, maybe monthly or a couple times a month at that place as well. But those were good old days, and I just reflect on them and, you know, just some of the things I said, and hopefully I can explain them.
Beautiful. Thank you, Brother Eman. Who introduced you to Alex Young?
I would say, you know, I reflected on that myself just a few days ago, and I came up with this, and I try to be honest with myself. I embrace Islam, I think, for selfish reasons. I would say the first influence, since I'm from Gary, Indiana, my hometown, there was a, I don't know what temple it was in Gary, Indiana, which number it was, but, of course, it was right next to Chicago. So sometimes on a Sunday, I'd be in the car with my parents and my siblings, and we would ride past Stony Island Avenue, and I would see these ladies in these clean white dresses and white hair coverings. And then in Gary, I would see the brothers selling the Muhammad Speaks newspaper at the time on the corner. And there was this big building, a couple of streets. I believe it was on the street next to Jackson Street, where the Jackson 5 grew up at. And it was a big sign of a star and crescent. And I didn't know at that time, we're talking about in the 60s and the early 70s, what all that meant. But nevertheless, in around high school, so I got high school started for me in the 10th grade in Gary. And so that would have been like 1977 or so. My brother, Akram Ali Bilal, my oldest brother, he embraced Islam under the leadership of Imam W.D. Muhammad. And I was trying to follow in his footsteps, everything he did. So when he started smoking weed or whatever, and he was womanizing, he was out on the street hustling, I looked up to him. He was... But then one day he came home, and my father, who was a deacon in the church, he asked him something like, "What, you need to get that pork out the refrigerator, Daddy. You know, you need to, you know." My father didn't drink or anything, but, you know, they had their share of pork chops and all of that stuff. But anyway, he challenged him on that, and I'm just sitting back now. I'm in high school, and my brother is maybe 5 or 6 years older than me. And I'm like, what's going on here? And then he starts challenging him or speaking to him on some verses in the Bible. And my father seemed to be tongue-tied because he couldn't answer those questions. And I'm, again, observing, like, what's going on here? And then my brother goes in the basement and starts praying in this funny language. And I'm like, what in the hell is going on here? And so anyway, he kept good relationship with me, even though I made fun of him. I would get with my friends. I would say, my brother done lost his damn mind. He's gone crazy and all of this. But in the 10th grade in high school, I was in social study class. I remember clearly we had to write a paper. This was my social study class on any subject we wanted to, and I think this occurred maybe in the first month of the school year. And because we had a 1966 World Book Encyclopedia in the basement in my home, I said, I somehow went to the I Encyclopedia, and Islam was in there. And I wrote my article on Islam from the World Book Encyclopedia. And I got an A on that paper, which knocked me out. I'm like, really? I didn't know what I had did, but I know I got an A on that paper. And so I guess that was my first wake-up call to Islam is powerful. It has a lot of power to it. But I went on with my life until I graduated high school, and I used to play keyboards in a band, and you know, my goal was to, after graduation from high school, to this band, hang in there as long as I can. Hopefully we'll become famous, something like the Jacksons, because the Jacksons' first cousins were in the band. Three of them was in the band. And I also had went to the what's called the Career Center in my high school years for half a day in high school and learned a little bit about electronics. And so my goal was either to work in the steel mills, because that's what Gary was known for in terms of employment, large employment, or become a famous musician. And, well, come February, the year I graduated in June of 1979, but come February 1980, I was broke. I was working in a restaurant. I still was in the band, but my father used to always drive to the Chicago, Indiana state line to buy a lottery ticket, because Indiana didn't have the lottery, but Chicago, Illinois did. So he used to drive there every Sunday, and I used to ride with him sometimes in his car. And I told him on this particular day, it seemed like it was a Saturday as I reflect, it was in the wintertime. I told him, drop me by the recruiter's office on downtown Gary when we get back. And the reason I think I told him that as I reflect was I had a friend down the street from me in Gary, older guy. He was my older brother's age. And he had went to the military, and he came back saying, hey, he got the GI Bill, and he was able to get money for school, for college, and, you know, and he was able to get his, you know, life on track joining the Air Force. And so, again, I'm looking up to the older brothers in my neighborhood, and also I asked my father to take me back. It's a college in Chicago called the Loop College. And the same brother I'm talking about, his name is Danny Wilson. His name is Danny Wilson. He's still alive. But anyway, he used to play the organ, the keyboards. And he said, you know, by going to school, you can learn music theory and, you know, and you can become a studio musician or whatever. So I asked my father to take me by to Luke College. And he took me. And that was about it. He wasn't going to pay no tuition for me, and really, I wasn't ready for it. So I told him to drop me by the recruiting office, which he did. And that was the beginning of me saying I'm going to join the Air Force. And so, you know, while I was in the Air Force, because of my brother, boot camp, you had a certain regiment, a certain day, every day, you know, you get up early to the reveille and roll call, muster, and all of that. And then you go and you eat your meal. And because I had already heard about the pork and how it was not good for you, and also I started weaning myself off of it slowly, you know, I rejected a lot of that in my diet when I was, you know, in basic training. And also, my brother was sending me, it's called, I think it was called the World Community of Al-Islam newspaper. It wasn't called the Muslim Journal then. It was, it became the AM Journal, American Muslim Journal. But before that, he was sending me those papers. And so one day, we had our inspection. You know, you get inspected for how well and neat you keep your drawers, where you keep your underclothes, your socks, and stuff like that. And then you had your personal drawer at the bottom. And so my technical instructor—that's what they called him in the Air Force—he told me I had to get rid of those newspapers I had. And I got offended. I spoke out. I said, well, why I got to get rid of these and you let me, them keep their other little magazines and other little things in their drawer. And so anyway, he failed me on that inspection. And so I had to go in front of the first sergeant to see, you know, what they were going to do, either keep me in that troop or put me in another troop or whatever. And so the first sergeant called me in the office. His name was Mess Sergeant Battle. This was in San Antonio, Texas. And he said, and at that time my name was Lyndon Joyner. It wasn't Bilal. He said, well, why did Sergeant Setlowski put you in here and fail you on the inspection? And I told him, I said, he's a racist. He didn't want me to keep these papers, da-da-da-da-da. And then Mess Sergeant Battle, who was a African-American, he used to smoke a pipe, but he's African-American. And he said, well, who was your leader? I said, Wallace B. Muhammad. And he said, that's my leader, too.
Wow.
And then he told me, he said, Airman Joyner, go out there and tell Sergeant Setlowski to come in here. And next thing I heard, he was chewing Sergeant Setlowski out. And then he told me, well, what my fate was, they put me 2 days back, but they put me in an honor flight. You know, honor flight was like the flight that had been, you know, you compete with the other flights while you're in boot camp. And so this was like the top flight. So they put me in that flight. And so, you know, the boot camp in the Air Force was only 6 weeks. You know, I had to stay maybe 6.5 weeks, but I completed it with an honor flight. And then I got stationed in tech. I went to tech school. Part of my tech school was in, what was that, Illinois, Rantoul, Illinois, at Chanute Air Force Base. I got put into what I wanted to, an electronics field. I got put into weather equipment maintenance. And so we had to go through a long tech school, which was a blessing because we learned electronics from the component level. And so I had to go to Great Lakes Naval Station for 8 months to get that basic ET training. And that's the same training that the nuclear technicians got that were in the Navy. So we were very, a few Air Force people had the privilege to go to that base and get that type of training. And it was there that I made, well, actually, not that I really still hadn't come to El Islam completely, but I did go to hear Imam W.D. Muhammad once on a Sunday with my brother, and I can still remember I was blurry-eyed. I didn't really understand it or anything like that. But I know this is a long story and all, but I'm going to get to the bottom line here. So when I finished my tech school and all, I got stationed at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. And on winter break, I decided to go home to Gary, Indiana, but I had some friends that graduated with me from high school that were attending Indiana University, State University. And so I was going to pick them up, go from Ohio to Indiana, pick them up, and then take them home to Gary, you know. And so I did that, and on our way home, we slid into a ditch. And these brothers were drinking beer and all of that while we were in the car doing it. And that was the last beer I ever had, because that's what I felt was holding me back from really embracing Islam the way that I wanted to, because I had also started attending the local masjid in Ohio. And so I quit drinking beer at that time. I had quit my smoking and all of that. And then, I came back. And so this was like in 1980, 81, somewhere around there. And I, you know, embraced Islam. And from that point, I hadn't looked back. And I actually became the lay leader for Islam on the Air Force Base there, and spoke at several occasions as the Islamic representative, even though I had very little knowledge, but I had a lot of faith, and I was, you know, like had been awakened from the dead by Allah himself, you know. So Yeah, that's a long story, but mashallah, thanks for letting me, didn't interrupt me. I probably lost my train of thought.
No, sir, it's important. And you take me right where I want to go next.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and let me just say this, being a spouse of a veteran, and specifically during 1986 and 88, I was exposed to so much of military life and the challenges of our servicemen and our families. But one of the things I was so excited to see in your bio, because I know the effort that it took, I mean, this took years, you helped facilitate getting the first Muslim chaplains officially sworn into the U.S. military in 1993.
Yep.
Please tell our listening audience how this came about.
Okay. All right. So at this time, in the mid-'80s, I was stationed in California at Norton Air Force Base, which I believe is closed now, in Riverside, California. And again, I was there. I was the Islamic lay leader there. I got an assignment to go overseas to Turkey, Ankara, Turkey. And I was very excited. Went over to Ankara, Turkey. I was a Muslim at this point, and had been Muslim for 5 or 6 years under the leadership of Imam W.D. Muhammad, so I was very well-versed, very knowledgeable in al-Islam, and, you know, had went through Ramadan 5 or 6 years at this time. And so I had some experience. And after my 2 years in Ankara, Turkey, was up, I got stationed in Washington, D.C., at the Pentagon. And with that point, where I would go to Juma at Masjid Muhammad, now called the Nation's Mosque in Washington, D.C., and used to be Mosque number 4, the first building built from the ground up under the leadership of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Number 4 was the first one that was built by the community, indigenous African Americans in this country. But nevertheless, I would go there for Juma, and I would see several other military service men and a few women in uniform at the Juma, which let me know I was not alone. And during this period, I had met several other Muslims in the military from all branches and different locations, and we kept contact. And so we formed a organization or a group called the Muslim Military Members. And one of our priorities was to get a Muslim chaplain in the military. And there was a group in Washington, D.C. called the American Muslim Council at that time. And the American Muslim Council became one of the organizations that helped us along the way in terms of having, you know, a bigger umbrella to say that, you know, we can identify with. And because not every member in the military was a follower of Imam W.D. Muhammad. And sometimes I had to, you know, tolerate them. And I'm talking about African Americans. Not all of them, you know, some of them came from, different ideologies, Islamic Brotherhood or what have you, you know. And but we worked together because we all knew that there were no Islamic chaplains in the military. And it just so happened that that period, the military was open to Islam, you know, in terms of facilitating the needs of the Muslim soldiers. I think it was because what was going on in the world, you know, the Iran crisis had just sort of got over. We were helping the Mujahideen in Afghanistan defeat the Russians. And so, you know, there was a whole lot of world events. And, of course, Imam W.D. Muhammad was on the scene and making Islam popular.
Yes.
Popular mm-hmm. Americans and around the world. Because even when I was in Turkey, one of the Turkish Imam showed me a book that he had, and Imam Muhammad was in that book as this new upcoming leader, you know, and things like that. And so we formed this group, and because I was working at the Pentagon, I used my position to often go to the Pentagon chaplain's office, the chief of chaplains for the military, and do the legwork, a lot of legwork. And eventually all the paperwork was in order, and the candidate, Imam Abdul Rashid Muhammad, who fortunately was a member of our community and still is a member of our community, he became the first chaplain. And he served proudly, and he represented very excellently in that position. And when we had our virtual Veterans Day event last year, 2019, he mentioned that there were at least 15 Muslim chaplains serving at around that time, because he currently works as an endorsement agent. Agent, I think under ISNA or something like that. So, you know, that's how that came about. The ground troop, the troops in uniform, pretty much did most of the legwork to make that happen. And the American Muslim Council was the endorsing agent.
So, wow. The ground troops. This is important.
Yeah.
Thank you. You're currently, presently, National Commander of the Muslim American Veterans Association, MAVA, which began in 1997 at post number one in Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
and now has several posts around the country. A few years back, Brother Imam, the servicemen of the Vietnam and Korean Wars who finally started to be recognized. How important was this?
Okay. Yeah, that's very important because, as you know, most of them, a lot of them, the majority of them probably saw battle. They saw actual warfare. And especially the Vietnam veterans, a lot of them have lasting effects of the Agent Orange. And of course, that became a very unpopular war. As we know, Muhammad Ali, he is famous for saying, "The Viet Cong ain't done nothing to me. Y'all the ones who have called me nigger, not them." And they still love him. Utmost love, give him the utmost respect and love to this day, you know. And when I was over in Turkey, if they didn't know anything else, they would say, Clay, you know, Ali, Clay, whatever. So it's very important because, like I said, these soldiers saw, many of them saw warfare, and they suffered from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and they deserve their benefits. And of course, my father, he fought in the Korean War as well.
Ooh, wow. And
the founder of MAVA, Mujahid Muhammad, may Allah have mercy on him, grant him paradise, he spent 441 days as a POW in the Korean War.
Ooh.
So he also started, or he was one of the founders of the first Muslim Boy Scout troop in Philadelphia, and then he came to Washington, D.C., and founded that Boy Scout troop. So, you know, these men, most of these men that I know of from serving as the national commander of MAVA, they didn't necessarily join the military for the same reason that many of us in our generation joined. Like I said, one of the reasons I joined the military because it gave me an opportunity to get a college education with the GI Bill and things like that. And a lot of them, they joined not only because they were drafted, but they wanted to bring themselves into their manhood, as well as they knew that African Americans had got a bad rap by the racist society that we live in, that, you know, we're not as good as the rest, which, of course, the Tuskegee Airmen and several other groups like that proved that wrong. But they also went in knowing that their sacrifice and their service would benefit generations to come of our race, you know, of our ethnicity, by them serving proudly and doing their part to defend and protect our country as the citizens which they are.
Yes, sir. A few weeks ago, we had our engineer on, Imam Musa Abui. His father was one of the, I believe, Tuskegee Airmen. So this is important, and how important our legacy is,
mm-hmm,
of our family life.
Mm-hmm.
Brothers and sisters, the show is brought to you by New Africa Excellent, Murad Speaks. Let's speak about another triumph in your legacy. In 1992, you were able to perform Hajj.
Yes.
And was a part of the first delegation of U.S. military members hosted by Saudi Arabia's government. Please expand on this for us. And I want to know the experience delegation came about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it happened real suddenly. I didn't expect to go on Hajj in 1992. But because, like I said, one of our members, that associations that I had with another member, his name was, I can't even remember his first name, but we called him Brother Abdullah. He was stationed at Fort Gordon in Georgia. And I had met him before I went to Turkey. I had to get some special training on a system that I had to maintain when I went overseas. And I met him because I went to the Jummah that they had on the base. Unfortunately, mostly all the bases now, if there's Muslims on those bases, they have Jummah. And if they don't have Jummah, it's only because nobody stepped up to say they wanted it. But anyway, I met him before I went over to Turkey. And so when I got back from Turkey, he had still, I don't know what his job was, but he could travel over to Saudi Arabia. He had formed several associations with some of the Saudi military members, et cetera. And to make it kind of short, he asked me, he said, "Do you want to go on Hajj this year or in the next few weeks?" And I was really like, really? I can do that? And, of course, if you get your paperwork in order, it can happen. And so I also contacted Imam Tawu Sharif, several other Muslims. I think there were maybe about 10 of us. They went. So we had to, of course, get approval from our command, whichever command we was in, to travel. And we took a space availability flight. And what that is a military takes flights, you know, several times a week to different countries, to Germany, to Saudi Arabia, any other place. And if you get on the space availability list, you can, and if some seats available, you can get on that flight and you could, you know, go over to wherever they're going. And so out of Philadelphia, there was a flight that went to Germany so many times a week, a big 747. And so those of us coming from this area, we were able to get on that flight. And then from Germany, there were flights going into Dhahran, Saudi Arabia. And so we were able to make that flight as well. And when we got there, Brother Abdullah met us. And they put us up in the nice military quarters they had there in Saudi Arabia. They prepared us. You know, only thing we had to do was make sure we got our shots. We had to get our shots before we traveled. And, of course, we had to have the leave available to, you know, time it took to do the Hajj. And that's pretty much what happened. And we stayed in Dhahran until we traveled by bus to Medina. And the Saudi government took care of all our accommodations, our food, and our ihram, our two-part clothing that we wear on Hajj, our sandals and those types of things. So it really didn't cost us, you know, anything except, you know, a few hundred dollars or something to take care of our own personal needs. And you know, we performed the rituals then we had to leave Saudi Arabia and catch another flight back to the United States, same way, space availability. And so it worked out very well. And the following year, we sort of formalized that program for military members and made it a lot easier and simpler for those who wanted to do it. And that program went on for a couple of years. And I don't think it's still formalized as a program anymore. But that's how we did it in 1992. And I think at least until 1995, it was being done. Because a lot of the soldiers that embraced Islam, you know, during that period of Desert Storm and Desert Shield while they were over in Saudi Arabia, because the Saudis were able to freely teach them Islam, you know, so to speak. But what I found out, a lot of the African Americans, when I went on Hajj, they had been taught by the Saudis. They didn't know hardly anything about Islam in America. Mm-hmm. They might know, they might have been calling Honorable Elijah Muhammad a disbeliever, and they might have didn't hear nothing about Imam W.D. Muhammad or what they did here. They might have downplayed it. But, you know, they were like new babies, really. A lot of them went on the Hajj, and they didn't even know what they were doing. They were, I know brothers were throwing food off of the back of a truck, you know, while you're on Hajj, you know. And one of the brothers took it as a game. I say, brother, this ain't no game, you know. This is Hajj. This is the fifth pillar. As one brother told us as we were leaving Saudi Arabia, a military person, and we told him what we had just did, and he was like, "Yeah, that's the highlight of the Muslim life, of a Muslim's life to make the Hajj." And so, anyway, it's very important to, I think, as an American Muslim, to follow someone like Imam W.D. Muhammad, because he's a genuine American Muslim, you know, and not an import, so to speak, or immigrant.
Such an important mention, and the blessing.
Yes.
Of being, you know, being able to make Hajj cost effectively. How was your experience going through the Hajj process
Well,
what elevation did you experience after that experience?
Well, I was, you know, spiritually very, very high on at that time, uplifted, because earlier that same year, as the lay leader for the Muslims at the Pentagon, I hosted a luncheon, and Imam W.D. Muhammad was the honored guest at this luncheon. And Muhammad Ali, the great world champion heavyweight boxer, he attended this luncheon as well. And so I was, you know, that whole year, 1992, was a very highlight of my life, I can say, because of that. And so that luncheon happening the day before Imam Muhammad became the first Muslim to open the Synod in prayer, and going on Hajj in 1992, and then the following year, getting the first Muslim chaplain in the military. I had separated from the military at that time when the first chaplain, and I think it was December the 5th, 1993, and my final day on active duty was October the 15th, 1993, but I was still involved, you know. And so, you know, the Hajj, it's just, you know, that's an obligation. It's one of the five essentials, pillars of the religion. And so to perform that, and, you know, myself, you know, it was just Allah has to invite you to his house in Mecca to even be there. And then experience in Arafat and staying in Mina in the tents and going around the Kaaba, running between Safa and Marwa, getting you as a man, getting all your hair cut off. You know, all of those things are very spiritually uplifting, and, you know, they're preparing you for a longer journey that we all have.
Yes, sir. Thank you. For the past 4 years, you have been responsible for writing a very popular weekly article in the Muslim Journal called Mava Speaks. Tell us why this is so significant.
Yes. So, of course, the Muslim Journal is the oldest Muslim newspaper in this country, and it's been produced weekly for the last 46 or so years. And so the Muslim American Veterans Association is founded in 1997. Didn't become a national organization until around 2006. And at that time, I was the Post 1 commander in Washington, D.C. But because it had become national, several other veterans had joined and became the national commander and vice commander, adjutant, quartermaster, and, you know, it was all being put together. And so the Muslim Journal has always supported the Muslim veterans. Matter of fact, that influenced me when I was in boot camp. And I used to get the paper, and I would every now and then see a Muslim veteran, or I would read something about a Muslim veteran in the Muslim Journal. But when we became a national organization, the MAVA, Muslim American Veterans, Muslim Journal allowed us to have a column. And so that column was written weekly, something in association with the military, Muslims, veterans, about entitlements, history, what the organization was doing, you know, all those things. And around 2015, I became the national commander, and it became my responsibility to continue with that column. And so, you know, I took the responsibility to making sure that every week we have something new, fresh, interesting, informative, beneficial to the readers of our great newspaper. And continue to today. It's on page 8 of the Muslim Journal every week called Mava Speaks. And we're so thankful to Sister Aisha Mustafa and the Muslim Journal staff for allowing us to have that column and allowing us to continue it and encouraging me every time I see them at the time to be grateful or some other event. They always encourage me and let me know that the article is very popular and appreciated.
Yes, sir. Now we're going to talk about a little bit of family life, brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
So, Imam Halal is, I'm just going to do a little introduction here. The proud dad of entertainer Arta Ray. So if we can hear about some of your personal family life experiences and what you try to impart on your family, you and your wife, if you would, please.
Yes. First, I want to give thanks to my wife, Sister Sabah Bilal. And yesterday we had Juma prayer at my house. Since the pandemic, occasionally we'll have Juma, and since January the 1st was a special day, and Juma is always a special day, as we say, the greatest day of the week of the year. And the week before that, on Christmas, the December 25th, we had Juma for the first time. I allowed my sons to be the khatib. And both of my sons grew up in this community. They attended Clara Muhammad School in Washington, D.C., and then they went to the Village Learning Center, which was also run by one of our Muslim sisters, Sister Imani Abdullah. But anyway, they gave my son, Nadi, who was my oldest son, he also is a graphic artist, a very accomplished one at that. And he gave the Juma Kutbah last week, and he wanted to speak about investment, which he did a great job for, especially for his first time. And then yesterday my son, Abdul Aleem, he talked about honoring your spirit. And so, you know, this is part of family life. Family was together. Afterwards, we broke bread together and talked and so forth. And, you know, and my oldest daughter, as you mentioned, Arta Ray, I used to manage her for several years because she had made several CDs and she attended the Duke Ellington School of the Arts in Washington, D.C., as well as my other son, Nabi. And so, you know, I've seen her professionalism. You know, she definitely made more accomplishments and come farther in the music industry than I did when I was involved with in high school, and also after high school. I did some things for the Muslim community with music. But my other two children, Karima, she is a very beautiful young lady, and my two grandchildren came from her womb. And then my youngest daughter, Yusra, again, she attended Clara Muhammad School here in Washington, D.C. And, you know, we are a close-knit family. And, you know, their mother is still around in Washington, D.C. as well. And so they're known in the community as well. But, you know, I'm trying to still raise them to become, you know, more responsible to a lot of things in the society and the community that I'm sure that their talents could help our community continues to grow and to establish community life.
Yes, sir. Thank you. What was the most interesting country you traveled to?
Well, I only spent my assignment in Turkey. I was in Turkey for 2 years. You know, I spent a day here, a couple of days there in London and Spain and Germany. But, I met, you know, in Turkey, Turkey was the place in which I, like I said, I stayed there for 2 years, learned how to speak the language where I could communicate in the marketplace, and also the Turks are very hospitable people, and they love al-Islam, even those, even the ones who say the women that don't dress, they know that they're Muslim. They know that, and they you can't take that away from them. You know, in the morning when it was time for Fajr prayer, you hear the adhan called at every mosque. So you hear, you know, it be drowned, Allah, la, 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 what, la, la, what, you know, it just echoes in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it's Ramadan, you're talking about turned up and on steroids, you're talking about, I mean, you can hardly, it's more crowded almost in Saudi Arabia to get into the masjid sometimes. But in Omaha, it's almost that crowded. And as you know, when you go on Hajj, if the Turks, many times they put their national flag symbol on their Ihram, which is a star and a crescent, similar to what the Nation of Islam uses as well, the red background and the white trim. But I would love to meet some of my Turkish friends that we established a great love and friendship for each other. And I felt uncomfortable once walking down the street and one of the Turks wanted to hold my hand.
Wow, that culture is a different culture.
I know. I tried it, but I had to come out and get with this, you know.
Did you have a chance to visit the Blue Mosque?
Oh, yeah. That was in, I think that's Istanbul.
Correct.
Yeah. So I went to, I took tours there, Istanbul to Konya. Very interesting place Konya is. You see the janazas taking place, and they going through the streets with, you know, and there's a lot of old history there, Christian, Jewish, you know, Islamic history. They had museums there where they claim to have the beard of the prophet, and a lot of the swords and things like that of some of the companions of Sahaba. And it's a beautiful country along the Caspian, the Arabian Sea, and the mosque, many of them have been turned into museums, but, you know, this guy named Ataturk in the early 20th century, you know, he became the leader, and at one point they couldn't speak in Arabic. They had to, whatever they said, when they called the Adhan, they had to call it in the Turkish language, and, you know, they got over all of that, you know, and everything. But, and, you know, of course, and like in other, many other countries, the women were kind of oppressed, couldn't go to school and those type of things. But in Turkey, when I was there, you know, the women were more, I would say, liberated to the point, you know, they drove and they, you know, many of them, they didn't have to wear a scarf and, you know, and it was not a taboo, and, you know, because they had so many different cultures within their culture going on. But like I said, they are some of the most hospitable people, I would believe, on the planet.
Brother Imam, thank you so much. If you would, two things before we end the show. Give our listening audience a final message, and then before we end the show, a contact if anyone would like to reach out to you.
Okay.
You may proceed with the final message.
Okay, this is Allah Rahman Rahim. Allah says to us in the Quran that we act according to our disposition. I think the word is shakilat. And so we should strive to have the best disposition and be as grateful and thankful to the Creator for everything, as it says in Surah 54 and 55. Don't deny any of Allah's favors, or which of Allah's two favors will you deny? Don't deny any of Allah's favors. And that's my message. And my contact, you can reach the Muslim American Veterans Association at our website, which is mavanational.org, mavanational.org. And there you can find our email. It's info@mavanational.org. And you can find me in Washington, D.C. I work with all the Muslim communities here. So if you ask most of them about me, they can tell you where to find me. And I'd like to thank Brother Murad Muhammad for allowing me to meet you, Sister Salima, because it was through you that I met him, and he's doing a wonderful job in helping my daughter find opportunities for her great talent that Allah has blessed her with.
Yes, sir, and I want to give recognition to Sister Fitra. She's right there in your community. We put all of us together. She works tirelessly in the community.
That's true. And we love Sister Fitra. We love and appreciate Sister Fitra. She's a beautiful sister.
Yes, sir, yes, sir. Thank you. It has been an honor. Inshallah, we look forward to having you again in the future.
Anytime, sister.
Thank you so much. I greet the listening audience. Assalamu alaikum. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellence. Murad Speaks. Thank you for joining us today. You may reach me at Salima, salimah@gmail.com. Assalamu alaikum.